Christopher Columbus takes a lot of flack these days. More and more, he's seen as a lucky idiot at his best and a genocidal historical villain at his worst. My home city of Chicago's whole public school system just 86th Columbus Day altogether and replaced it with Indigenous Peoples Day, to much justified celebration. As for myself, I have never hesitated in trash-talking Columbus before. He was not a morally good person, even by the standards of the day. He initiated a world exchange that inadvertently caused tens of millions of deaths, and while that may not have been his intention, he also did set the cruel standard for the era of colonialism that would follow in his wake. Say all of these true statements about the old Admiral Columbus, and yet you also can't deny that of all the humans who have ever lived, he's probably the only one to bring about a whole new era in the history of life on this planet. Christopher Columbus began what would become a permanent European, African, and Asian occupation of the Americas. He reconnected the two hemispheres which had been sundered for eons, and in doing so, initiated the era of globalization. The last time we talked about Columbus's voyage, in episode 20, we got into a lot of what foods started where and where they ended up. Just the initial exchanges, in other words. We just barely began to delve into some of the human consequences, because in the end, of all the commodities, foods, and species that were altered as a result of contact between Eurasia and the Americas, it was Homo sapiens, humans themselves, who were changed most of all. This episode is The Columbian Exchange Part 2, The Aftermath, how the world was deeply connected and deeply scarred by Columbus's voyage. 1492 marked not only the discovery of the Americas by Europe, but also the discovery of the entire world by everyone else. The Columbian Exchange was not some sort of one-and-done event where the world changed and then went on. When food and eating habits change, everything else changes with it. Long-distance trade had existed for thousands of years prior in both hemispheres, but nothing as fast, continuous, and sprawling as the global networks that emerged after Columbus. It would shape all of world history and world cuisine that was to come, forming fusion cuisines and fusion societies. And that is why Columbus, despite his flaws, remains an important figure in history, worthy of study. Columbus's discovery fully broke Middle Ages ideology. It sort of invented the idea of discovery for Europe in a society that had believed life was stagnant or decaying. That alone would make his so-called discovery a momentous historical event. But it was the ecological and the biological changes made to planet Earth and its species that would turn the 1492 voyage into perhaps the most important human event since the development of agriculture itself. Hold on tight, as we'll be bouncing all around the globe to tell this story. We've got a lot of history to cover. You may experience some turbulence and disorientation. To give you just an idea of how momentous this all is, what if I started by telling you that Columbus's reknitting of the Eastern and Western hemispheres together would cause rapid and massive climate change all over the planet? For almost two centuries, from about 1550 to 1750, the Northern Hemisphere experienced a geothermal anomaly that historians call the Little Ice Age. Over the years, there have been a number of theories on why Europe and Asia had such a long era of icy and terribly snowy winters, late springs and brisk summers, wreaking havoc on ecosystems and agriculture across the hemisphere. But most scientists and historians today agree that the true cause of the Little Ice Age was changes in the human population worldwide, as a direct result of the Columbian Exchange. Recall that Indian populations across North and South America pre-1492 managed their environments with mass burnings. They made the Great Plains and the smoldering black earth of the Amazon with fires on a continental scale. Smoke would shroud what are today entire states for weeks at a time throughout the year, until Columbus came along and ended all of that. Well, not him personally, but Eurasian bacteria, viruses, parasites, mass disease, in other words, moved across the Americas with terrible speed, killing millions and unraveling the millennia-old system of human landscape management. Tens of millions perished. Flames turned to embers, which soon subsided completely. Trees soon reclaimed the spaces that had been kept clear by fire in the past, exponentially swelling their numbers and creating a huge reforestation of the Americas, turning the continent into a vast wooded wilderness full of millions of trees hungry for greenhouse gases. So, to make this too long of a story shorter, the idea is simple. The loss of Indian societies and their fires, and the sudden exponential growth of tree populations as a result, subtracted a monumental amount of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. It's actually the opposite problem we have with climate change today. Not enough CO2 in the air to trap in the sunlight, meaning that less heat was retained, which meant a massive planet-wide cooling. Farmers and food supplies all over were devastated as temperate climates tipped their scales toward winter. Old world crops failed all over the continent, and famine loomed. But it could have been worse. Serendipitously, the same exchanges that had caused this little ice age also provided crops that could handle it. American foods and their higher tolerance for what were traditionally thought of as harsher climates and poorer soils would keep the Little Ice Age from being a complete disaster for agriculture in Europe and Asia. Thanks to corn, potatoes, and sweet potatoes, people survived, and farming went on. But it sure wasn't easy during 200 years of Game of Thrones-style winters. Remember this Little Ice Age, as it'll be important again shortly. For now, it's just one, if one very potent, example of the many changes brought about by globalization. To really understand what happens next, we have to stray off the topic of food for just a little bit, but I promise it'll be relevant later on. You see, despite all the plants and animals freewheeling between continents after Columbus, of most interest to the Europeans and Asian people alike was silver. The Spanish had seized and dug up tons of the stuff in South America. Literally, they discovered a mountain in Bolivia that was made almost entirely out of silver so pure that at first they couldn't figure out how to smelt it. Once they did, though, they began shipping huge amounts of precious metals back home across the Atlantic. As all this silver made its way back to Europe, all the wealth that came with it proved to be a terrible curse as much as it was a boon. At first, silver from the Americas made Europe's elite more rich and powerful than they ever could have fantasized. But at the same time, more silver was pouring into Spain than its money supply could handle. Like an overflowing pot, American silver spilled into banks all across Europe, becoming the main currency in most of its major kingdoms. As monarchs began sharing currency, that is, silver from the Americas, the continent became more interconnected than ever before by its globalized money supply. Unfortunately, with flush pockets, the Spanish monarchy decided it would be a great time to launch a number of expensive foreign wars, with the Netherlands, with England, the Ottomans, France, you name it, each one overlapping with the last. The costs were staggering, but no worries, right? Silver's coming in by the tonload. But war is expensive. Even with all those literal ships full of money coming in, it wasn't enough to fully fund the fighting or even pay the army. Confident that more silver would flow in, the Spanish crown borrowed from foreign bankers to pay for all the wars. The bankers felt confident enough to lend because they felt the silver would keep flowing too. Debts piled up as everything got more and more expensive. Silver did indeed keep coming in, but not as much as expected. More than half was smuggled west to China in exchange for silk and porcelain. The Spanish crown desperately tried to halt all that wealth going to Asia, but its actions had almost no effect. The silver flowed where it wanted to. But there was a worse disaster coming, that having more silver would not have helped. At the time, no one saw it coming, but it's now something that's taught in the most introductory of economics courses. I'm talking about hyperinflation and currency devaluation. It goes like this. Surplus money increases the money supply, but all that extra cash floating around is paying for the same old goods and services. So prices rise to match the bigger supply that people have. More money flows in, press repeat. It's an inflationary spiral. Goods get pricier as the value of currency either can't keep up or actually falls. When this happens too fast, people's wages don't rise to match the new prices. This is what began to happen in the second half of the 1500s. The cost of grain and of living overall doubled across Europe, and even tripled in some places. But wages couldn't keep pace. Food prices in particular skyrocketed, and the poor couldn't even afford to eat. Rebellions and famines sprung up all over Europe in what developed into what historians call the general crisis of the 16th and 17th centuries. Once again, though, American crops did sort of save the day, or at least keep things from getting as bad as they could have. Newly discovered maize, beans, potatoes, and sunflowers were feeding people even when their old staples got way too expensive to buy. That helped, but didn't solve the situation. Prices just kept rising, and the economy was in total chaos. And when the price of silver itself began to fall, things would only get uglier. And events would not go much better in the Far East. Chinese monarchs got some very strange reports in the late 16th century. Western barbarians, people from Europe, had arrived in Asia wanting to trade. They had not come from the West by land, as happened from time to time. Instead, they had shown up from the East, having crossed the Pacific Ocean. Naturally, China was at first skeptical and not willing to open up trade with these people. At that point, China was the richest, most powerful state on the planet, by just about any metric. Military might, nutrition and health, production, the arts, culinary arts in particular. Remember the chef-owned restaurants of the Song Dynasty? For most of their history, Chinese people regarded Europe as too poor and backwater to be of interest to them. Until now, they had mainly only had wool to trade, which was no match for Chinese silk. Silver, on the other hand, was something that China greatly desired. For complicated reasons you could probably have a whole podcast about, the Chinese economy and currency had experienced quite a bit of tumult over recent generations. The invention of paper money came with Asia's own discovery of hyperinflation. Merchants and traders used any old coin they could get, as currencies frequently came and went. Merchants in the 1500s were using ancient coins from the medieval era rather than contemporary worthless money. So in general, you could say that the early modern economy in China was quite chaotic and unpredictable. So as a solution, merchants turned to silver. hard to come by, but dependable in its reliable value. The problem was, though, that the stuff was in very short supply, until Europe showed up with shiploads of it from across the Pacific. Traders and elite buyers gladly welcomed the large ships literally full of money, which they could trade silk and porcelain for, things that the Europeans desperately wanted. Because while the transformations beginning to take shape in world society and ecology began in the Americas, things would really heat up once the Europeans pushed further west, crossing the Pacific to make Columbus's dream of a sea route to Asia come true, finally knitting the globe together all the way around. This had always been the big prize. Two whole continents in the Americas to exploit were well and good, but European explorers' original goal had always been to get to India, and even more so to China. Once they actually did that, and made contact with Chinese merchants in the Philippines in 1570, the die on globalization was truly cast. Trade networks appeared overnight and grew exponentially. Tons and tons of mineral wealth flowed from America to China, and equal quantities of silk and porcelain went the other way. Like we mentioned, both the Spanish and Chinese rulers tried to restrict this trade, but found they were almost powerless to stop it. Spanish silver literally became the Chinese money supply, too. And Chinese officials were right to be scared of this situation. The nation's currency was now entirely dependent on foreigners and how many unknown variables. And the same economic problems that rocked Europe would show up here too. Even more staggering though, and certainly more surprising, were the shocks and changes brought to China's landscape, ecology, and farming system. As Charles Mann puts in his great book 1493, from which this episode is basically lifted, it was also the first large-scale, uncontrolled international exchange in Chinese history, and it would lead to uncontrolled change in Chinese life, as their fears about foreign influence became entirely borne out. Because as great as Chinese civilization was at that point, in many ways, it survived on the edge of a knife. By the 16th century, roughly one quarter of the entire world's population lived in China. And yet, to feed all these hungry mouths, they had 1/12 of the world's farmland. Even if you dispute those rough figures, it's hard to argue the simple fact that China as a state has always had a lot of people and always had relatively little land to feed them with. Especially with so many deserts and only two major rivers, the Yangtze and the Yellow, both prone to catastrophic flooding and disasters. For this reason, the little ice age that we talked about at the beginning was particularly hard on China. Decades of intense, freezing cold rains flooded agricultural valleys, washing away rice paddies and drowning all kinds of other plants. After every big rain and flood came a famine. Poor families had to eat semi-not-quite foods like tree bark and grass just to stay alive. So when American crops arrived via Japanese, Dutch, Portuguese, and Spanish sailors, it was kind of a big deal. No nation in the Old World was quicker to adopt American Indian foods than China. Corn, potatoes, chili peppers could all be grown outside the limited, disaster-prone rice and wheat zones, and double or triple agricultural yields of food overall. Today, China is the number one biggest producer of many of these foods. But no crop made an impact more than the sweet potato. As flooding and famine worsened, governments distributed newly acquired sweet potatoes as emergency food, showing people how to plant them just in time. Despite the climate catastrophe they were enduring, the next harvest somehow turned out pretty good. Disaster by famine had been averted, thanks to sweet potatoes. China was still in the grips of rebellion and upheaval. An outside group called the Manchus had invaded, seizing the Chinese capital and toppling the Ming dynasty for good. it was the beginning of the Qing Dynasty, and a whole new set of problems. Part of the old Ming Navy broke away and turned to trading, or piracy. Former state sailors began pillaging seaside communities en masse, creating a humanitarian disaster along China's coasts. To deny the raiders their supplies and slaves, the new Qing Dynasty decided it would evacuate every town and village along the coast, on the whole eastern bulge of China, a 2,500-mile expanse of coastline, and simply move them all inland. Bold idea. But of course, it was to have profound consequences. With no one on the coast to trade with, piracy did dry up, but so did legitimate trade. The silver trade was frozen, and the Chinese money supply strangled, causing massive deflation. Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of mostly poor coastal people had been relocated suddenly into the mountainous heartlands of central China. To complicate things, this was land that was already inhabited, and the newcomers from the coasts mainly belonged to a different ethnic group, not exactly a recipe to decrease tension. Landless and poor, the refugees were mocked as shack people. Their marginal land available for farming was completely unsuitable for growing wheat or rice, so of course they turned to sweet potatoes and corn, which would have been fine, except they needed land to grow it on. Thus, they were forced to cut and burn their way up into the mountains, creating new farmland for these new foods, but eliminating forests and root cover, and setting up for mass erosion down the line. But let's come back to that. For now, sweet potatoes were just the best. Not only did they stabilize a potentially volatile situation in society, but people liked the flavor, and didn't seem to mind eating them all the time. Most farmers' diets revolved around it, baked and boiled, ground into flour for noodles, mashed with pickles or deep-fried with honey, or chopped up and put into stews with turnips and soy milk, even fermented into a sweet potato wine. Many meals in China at this time might not have been out of place in a village high in the Andes Mountains. Meanwhile, in an attempt to further expand their territory and influence, the newfound Qing Dynasty was encouraging even more people to migrate south and westward. Another bold idea to move a large group of ethnically Han Chinese people into what they had deemed to be the empty spaces of China. This is similar in a lot of ways to the Manifest Destiny period that the Americans pushed for in the 19th century, because in actuality, these so-called unsettled places were actually just inhabited by non-Chinese people. That didn't stop anyone, though. Central and Eastern Chinese migrants poured out into the arid south and west of China, clearing yet more forests to plant more sweet potatoes, and corn. The amount of cleared farmland exploded, as did the amount of food grown there, and then the amount of people living there to eat the food. The population, in other words. American crops were an enormous boon, allowing more and more babies to be born and fed all over China, but particularly in these newly immigrated to places. In some areas, the population increased 100 times in less than a century. The overall population of China may have doubled to 300 million in a very short time, all thanks to exploiting new lands for only recently acquired crops that could be planted there. Look, China has always had a lot of people, but this is when it gets taken to a whole new level. Part of the reason that China became, and is still today, the world's most populous state is the crops of the Columbian Exchange. Too many mouths to feed? No problem. We've got corn and sweet potatoes working all over the place. But more problems were brewing, in part due to the very farming that was giving them so much success. Back in old world news, the price of rice was continuing to rise, because many farmers had stopped growing it, With potato and corn being alternatives available, it had become more profitable to not grow food, but instead to grow and sell new cash crops like sugar, peanuts, mulberry trees for silkworms, and most of all, tobacco, which was enormously popular across China and at one point ended up taking up over half of all total farmland in the state. Silk and tobacco could be traded for silver, for literal money in other words, which could then purchase anything else desired. Problem was that silkworms and especially tobacco drained the land. When farmers exhausted one former rice paddy by filling it with pipeweed year after year, they'd move on to the next one. And when they ran out of rice paddies, they went into the hills and mountains, into land that was already beginning to erode away thanks to mass sweet potato production. With almost nobody growing rice, people made up for their nutritional needs with even more corn and sweet potatoes, which were jammed into every nook and crevice available to create the necessary farmland. More and more forests were being demolished, more and more land left bare and exposed. Heavy rains from the Little Ice Age washed the land itself away. Soon erosion had removed so much topsoil that mountain bedrock was exposed. What weathered soil was left couldn't even hold water. It all washed downhill, making floods even worse. American crops were not only laying waste to the lands they were planted on, they were causing destruction in China's agricultural heartland miles downstream, in city after city after city. Things got especially bad for those rice farmers who remained. Erosion from cleared lands in the highlands drowned the rice paddies in the lower river valleys, further driving up prices, encouraging more corn and sweet potato production in the heights, which drowned more rice in the valleys. Quite a vicious cycle. Contemporary observers and officials figured out what was going on. They tried to ban the planting of these crops in the mountains, and they were almost completely ignored. The pace of land clearing even accelerated. How could it not? There was no other way to eat. You can't relocate mass amounts of people to a new foreign land and then tell them not to grow the only foods that will grow where they live. They have no other means to survive. Once the new foods and population boom in the new lands started, it almost immediately became an unsolvable, unstoppable problem. Constant floods led to constant famines and to constant unrest. This era of Chinese history is known for its terrible hunger and chaos as a result. And it all began with some desperate refugees planting corn and sweet potatoes when nothing else would grow. Which actually, in turn, had been caused by economic tumult from the silver supply pouring out of the Americas. The Columbian Exchange was already becoming the engine of world history. So as great as these new crops all seemed at the time, they clearly didn't always have good consequences in the long term. We already talked about that a bit in episode 20 with Europeans eating corn without having learned the Indian trick of slacking it in lime, therefore getting vitamin B deficiency and pellagra from a lack of essential vitamins. And then of course in the 19th century you get the Irish potato famine, the prime example of how when everyone is dependent on a single crop, even one as nutritious and dependable as potatoes, bad things are going to happen. When potato blight came and wiped out basically 100% of the Irish food supply, it was famine like had never been seen or experienced before in world history. And more than a third of the population of Ireland who didn't die exited as a result to other parts of the world. That's of course way down the line. Definitely a story for another podcast. By now, over two episodes, we've explored several stories and aspects of the Columbian Exchange, but we've still just really paid lip service to probably the most significant thing to be changed in all of this, Homo sapiens themselves. It wasn't just that more than one-fifth of all humans were wiped out by disease. The survivors came out into a new and unfamiliar world. And I'm not just talking about the Americas. In the centuries after Columbus, the whole world was remade anew. You see, for thousands of years, really for all of recorded history and then some, a simple fact was true, despite all the political and demographic changes you see across the ages. With few exceptions, almost all ethnically European people could be found in Europe. Similarly, there were very few Africans who lived outside of Africa, and all but a tiny percentage of Asian people lived east of the Hindu Kush, in Asia. People just didn't migrate much outside their continents of origin. In the reconnection between the East and West hemispheres brought about by Columbus, all of that was turned upside down. Very soon after 1492, something very strange started happening, and accelerating, a reshuffling of people around the globe, in the historical blink of an eye. Europeans in Asia and the Americas, Africans in the Americas, Asians and Chinatowns springing up all over the globe. What motivated this unprecedented, chaotic migration around the world? There's a lot of details to unpack to fully get that answer, but just briefly to start, let's get the most unpleasant fact out of the way. The main catalyst for all this movement of people was the African slave trade. Over three centuries and more than 35,000 voyages, approximately 11.7 million captive Africans were taken to the Americas and elsewhere. That number actually understates the suffering, as it does not account for the untold countless more who never made it and thus went unrecorded, those who perished along the way. But almost 12 million did make it to the New World in bondage. The implications of this become exceedingly clear when you compare that number to the number of European immigrants to the Americas, roughly 3.5 million. 12 to 3.5. That means that for every European that came to the New World, three Africans made the trip. Last episode, we already kind of blew up the idea that Europeans settled into a wild and empty continent. It had been populated by almost 100 million Indians prior. But now, even after that, we see that it was more so Africans who made up the next wave of settlers in America, and it was Africans who first developed the lands left in the wake of societies wiped out by disease. People from Africa soon became the majority in almost every place still not controlled by Indians, and this would hold for centuries afterward. It wasn't until the late 1800s, with new waves of immigration, that Europeans began to surpass them and become the majority. From about 1500 until then, though, the Americas were really more of an extension of Africa than of Europe. It was primarily Africans clearing forests, breeding crops and animals, building new towns and societies for what was to them this vast new continent. They reshaped the landscape into yet another something new, a hybrid ecology of old and new world species. They built the earliest version of what was to become the USA and Latin America. If you're picturing this transformation as something built by slaves under their master's orders, think again. We'll see in a little bit that so many slaves escaped their chains into the new American wilderness, newly free to interact with Indian societies and to build communities and shape the continent according to their own needs. This is all very interesting, you might say, but what's it got to do with food? A good historian will remind you that this new era of migration and people mixing together was fueled by the slave trade. A food historian will point out that the slave trade all comes back to sugar. We talked about sugar some in episode 20, and I'm pretty sure before that too, but there is plenty more to say about this almost magical spice, food, substance, whatever you call it. Sugarcane was first domesticated in New Guinea, amongst the rest of the Spice Islands, about 10,000 years ago. but from its very beginning, it was unlike any other spice. A taste for the stuff, or a sweet tooth, seems to be present in all cultures and places, fundamentally embedded in human DNA regardless of environment. It's been shown to be highly addictive, as much as any drug, and for that reason, sugar has been an amazingly powerful force in human affairs. But sugar ferments quickly, and for so long was impossible to transport, until some unknown farmers in Southeast Asia discovered the process of extracting the liquid from the plants, boiling it down into hard, transportable cakes. Now sugar could travel, and the sweets industry was born. Sugar made its way west along the Silk Road, and locals who tried it really wanted to grow their own supply. The Middle East is mostly too dry for sugarcane, but people figured out how to grow it with irrigation, so desperate they were for the stuff. It made its way to the Mediterranean coast, which is where Europeans first discovered it during the First Crusade. It's actually hard to overstate how much these invading knights, clerics, peasants, and conquerors loved sugar. In some ways, it almost made the whole miserable ordeal of the First Crusade worth it on some level, that they got to sample this sweet, heavenly spice and maybe even take some home with them. Immediately, Europeans set to trying to grow their own, and found that it fit into their already existing agricultural plantation system quite well. A plantation is a massive farm that tends to grow a single crop to maximize output. It also tends to process products on site into a preserved form so that they can be traded and sold in faraway places. Think olive oil, wine, or tobacco, later cotton. But sugar, in fact, turned out to be a better plantation crop than all of those. It had to be boiled down and processed on site, and people all over the world were clamoring for it, ensuring high profits. The only problem is climate and labor. It requires a very specific kind of equatorial climate, and enormous amounts of manpower are required, especially at planting and harvest time. European sugar plantations sprung up in Cyprus, Crete, Sicily, Spain, and numerous other Mediterranean islands. But no matter how much sugar was grown and produced, Europeans wanted more. Soon, there were no more Mediterranean areas left for sugar plantations. So, would-be sugar barons turned their eyes west of the then westernmost lands known, out into the Atlantic Ocean and the island chains of the Madeiras, the Azores, and the Canaries, all of which had excellent climates for growing sugar. There were so many failures, disasters, and restarts. Setting up sugar on these islands in the ocean didn't exactly go smooth, but the industry boomed even so. In the few decades before Columbus's voyage, sugar production increased 1,000 times. Prices soon began to fall, and profits were threatened. The only way for plantation owners to keep making money was to increase production. But to do that, they needed two things: new land to grow more sugar that didn't exist, and even more workers that they didn't have to slash and plant cane, extract the juice, and boil sugar. The land problem would be solved in a few years by Columbus's voyage, but Europeans solved the labor problem before that happened. Without appearing to give it much thought at all, they made a very fateful decision in world history. They bought slaves. More specifically, they began importing slaves on a mass scale from Africa to boost production in the Madeiras, Azores, and Canary Islands. Those islands were the first place where plantation farming and African slavery came together in their terrible union. Slavery on such a scale had been unheard of in Europe since Roman times, partly because Christianity forbade the enslavement of other Christians. At first, Europeans justified the capture of African or Asian or indigenous American slaves by suggesting that they intended to eventually convert them to Christianity and save them from the false doctrines of Islam. But when plantation owners found that they didn't like giving up their slaves who had converted, they turned to even more morally dubious arguments. Black Africans, theologians, and priests argued, did not qualify as fully human, and could not therefore become Christians, and could thus be permanently enslaved. Even people at the time called out this moral BS, but the remoteness of the Atlantic Islands meant that slavery could be kept conveniently out of sight, and people's sweet tooths could be satiated, if they would just turn a blind eye to the source. The use of slaves in sugar plantations would, of course, expand dramatically after Columbus discovered the New World for Europe in 1492. Columbus knew the sugar business from his connections to the Azore Islands, and accurately declared that the Caribbean islands he stumbled upon were ideal for growing the stuff. He brought sugarcane back with him as soon as his second voyage. With sugar about to thrive in the Caribbean, Columbus had set yet one more fateful, terrible example. The colonization of the New World would happen with slavery. There's one more piece of this puzzle missing before we can fully develop the picture of sugar and slavery in the Americas. Conveniently for this podcast, it's got to do with food and dining, specifically with spirits or distilled beverages, hard liquor in other words, and those cocktails we love so much today. Distilled alcohol changed Europe and their new colonies forever. But as per usual, to discuss European events and achievements, we must first discuss Muslim and Arab ones. Among the many inventions of Islam during the so-called Dark Ages of Europe was the refinement and solidification, or I guess I should say evaporation, of the technique to distill alcohol. Of course, itself an Arabic word. Ancients as far back as Mesopotamia had played around with vaporizing and then recondensing liquids, but Muslim alchemists set to work and turned a few ancient tricks into the science of distillation. Distilling alcohol like wine or beer makes it much stronger. Because vapor evaporates from the surface faster than alcohol boils, the vapor contains proportionately more alcohol and less water than the original liquid. Drawing off this vapor and condensing it produces a far more concentrated beverage. Repeating the process a number of times only increases the alcohol content of the final product. At first, Arabs and Europeans alike regarded distilled alcohol as medicine, and a kind of medical anesthesia. It could be consumed or applied directly to affected parts of the body. Proponents of so-called aqua vitae, or water of life, believed that it could preserve youth, improve memory, treat diseases, cure toothaches, blindness, and even paralysis. It was said that a spoonful of aqua vitae poured into the mouth of a dying person would give them the strength to speak one last time. Distilled liquor seemed supernatural because, in a sense, it was. It has a far higher alcohol content than any drink that can be produced via natural fermentation. Even the hardiest yeast can't tolerate more than 15% alcohol, which means that until Arab chemists figured out distillation, there had been a limit placed by nature on the strength of alcoholic beverages. Distillation allowed chemists to circumvent that limit, which had prevailed previously for thousands of years. Miraculous properties aside, distilled alcohol really gets you drunk. As knowledge of these liquors spread, they began to change from medicinal drinks into more recreational ones. And it was cheaper to ship, because you get more bang for your buck per volume of liquid. It didn't take long for distilled liquor to become enormously popular and a coveted trade good around the world. Burnt wine, as it was now called, or brandy wine, just brandy for short, became an economic good of such significance that its taxation and control became matters of vital international importance to states everywhere. The emergence of these new beverages occurred just as European explorers were first opening up the world's sea routes and initiating the Columbian Exchange. Unfortunately, these new alcoholic spirits, of course, became hopelessly entwined with colonial plantations and slavery. Europeans supplied African nations with a number of products in exchange for the human cargo necessary to expand sugar production. Brandy soon outpaced them all. Africans trading away captives valued distilled beverages because they were far stronger than their native grain-based beers and palm wines. It was soon customary for prospective slavers to present a large gift of brandy before even beginning negotiations with slave owners. Brandy oiled the gears of the slave trade in other ways, too. Everyone up and down the supply chain of slavery was paid with it, from the transporters to the guards and overseers to the slaves themselves. The connection between spirits, sugar, and slaves was further strengthened following the invention of a powerful new drink made from the waste products of sugar itself. The resulting beverage was known at first as Kill Devil for being an incredibly strong and not very pleasant liquor, hot and hellish and terrible. It quickly gained a reputation for blacking people out. Wine and beer were expensive to import, but Kill Devil could be made locally, not only for nothing, but with leftover molasses that might have otherwise gone to waste. A win-win for sugar producers. Kill Devil was sold to locals and sailors on passing ships, and soon became a booming worldwide industry. Some people began to refer to Kill Devil as rum bullion. Rum bullion was an English slang word that meant a brawl or a violent confrontation, probably chosen because that's what happened when people drank too much of it. Rum bullion, soon shortened to just rum, was the result of a convergence of materials, people, and technologies from all around the world, and it was the product of several intersecting historical forces. It was also the first known liquor to be made into a cocktail. Like we mentioned, rum was especially popular with sailors the world over. More alcohol with less liquid weight is everything to seafarers. It replaced beer very quickly as the traditional ration in most navies. This had predictable consequences on discipline and productivity, so it became mandated that rum should be diluted with water. Far more popular, though, became adding sugar and lime instead. The first primitive cocktail was probably invented on a ship at sea somewhere, likely in the British Royal Navy. Citrus and rum. Still classic. Good for passing the time, sailors' woes, and staving off scurvy. This concoction exploded in popularity and was known as grog. It was so popular that British soldiers became known as limeys forever after for their love of this rum and lime cocktail. That's a bit later on, though. The immediate significance of rum was as a new global currency and the first global drink. Rum spread through the Caribbean and beyond. It was given to new slaves as part of a seasoning process to wean them into terrible conditions. Rum subdued the unruly and controlled the weak. It was soon not just a popular drink, but a tool of social control. It closed the triangle linking spirits, slaves, and sugar. Rum could be used to buy slaves, with which to produce sugar, the leftovers of which could be made into rum to buy more slaves, and so on and on for 300 years. So it was that while brandy and other distilled spirits helped to kickstart the transatlantic slave trade, it was rum which made it a self-fueling and far more profitable business. The moral scourge of the day that would plague us down the rest of history right up into the here and now, born from sugar and liquor. The result of the triumphs of exploration, but not possible without the cruelties of the slave trade. Rum made from sugar is the embodiment of both the triumphs and the oppressions of globalization. Few seemed to consider these moral quandaries at the time. Plantations with African slaves making sugar and rum soon appeared all over the Caribbean and Latin America. But something very curious happened after that. Climate zones that are ideal for growing sugar are also the biggest vector zones for the old world disease malaria, which, via mosquito populations, infested the warmer areas of the New World with horrible regularity. Europeans and Indians died in mass numbers. Africans, being native to the same continent malaria evolved in, had more immunity. Malaria was such a devastating force in New World colonies that, in many cases, slaves would soon outnumber masters by 100 to 1. Plantations became malarial death traps, but not for Africans. One more reason that they made up the majority of initial colonizers in the Americas, and also found it quite easy to often escape their bonds. If you stop to wonder why such numbers of slaves would continue to cooperate with so few masters, well, they didn't. The story of slavery that often seems to get left out is the story of constant resistance. As a rule, slaves escaped when they could, and often did, especially in the wake of devastation from malaria. Runaways joined together in the wilderness, often joining or fighting with Indian societies, and or founding entirely new communities, villages and towns, a meeting and cooperation between Africans and Indians, fully outside of European view. Rebellious ex-slaves often raided the plantations which had held them in bondage, pillaging and destroying and stealing supplies and weapons for themselves. This was a serious problem for would-be sugar barons that you don't hear too much about these days. Raids and rebellions ground sugar production to a halt in many places. Sometimes the former slaves succeeded in driving the plantation system out of entire areas. See the Haitian Revolt several hundred years later. So if you think all these slaves just hung their heads and took it, think again. Resistance was constant and potent. The problem is that demand for sugar was just so high that these people would never stop trying. Once again, despite all the obstacles, the sugar business boomed. Spain's conquest of the Aztec and surrounding peoples introduced native Mesoamericans to sweets too, which soon found that they had a sweet tooth just as much as anybody else. New societies in the Americas began to clamor for more and more sugar, saving the industry and helping it to spread. Good times for the barons once again. This is when we talked about in episode 20 where everyday people could start to afford sugar, and for a while, overall health and wellness improved amongst the masses as a result of the extra calories. The other side we didn't talk about was that, as a consequence, sugar, which before had been used in everything in elite cookery, suddenly fell out of fashion with the upper classes. All that sweetness they had been dumping into dishes before became passé, saccharin. The same went for all spices, really, now readily available via the silver trade and no longer as prestigious as they once were. The heavily spiced and sweetened food, which for centuries had dominated elite cookery in Europe, suddenly had gone out of style. But even elite tastes, ever before the driver of world cuisine, couldn't halt growing sugar production. Now in Florida, Brazil, Mexico, just about everywhere possible, plantations were on the rise. This, of course, meant more and more African slaves. Everywhere Spanish and Portuguese conquistadors and sugar barons went, Africans went with them, outnumbered them, and this is why I'm giving them credit this episode for being the first true colonizers of the Americas, after the Indians, of course. Pouring by the thousands into Peru, Ecuador, Argentina, think about the great American cattle ranching culture, which we see both in the Great Plains of the USA, but also down in Argentina. This is, of course, a reinvention of traditional cattle ranching ways of life in West Africa. But more than Africans making up the majority of the population, another very interesting story was starting to take shape. As the world's peoples came together in the mixing ground, the melting pot, if you will, of the Americas, a hybrid society was coming into existence. It began at the very top. Conquistadors, including household names like Cortez and Pizarro, often married into elite families of Indians to bolster the legitimacy of their rule over the native peoples. They birthed a generation of mixed culture children, who were often the most powerful citizens in this new cosmopolitan society that was taking shape. To start, it was mainly European and Native American mixing, but that would soon change. With the spread of plantation slavery came the rise of the African population. With that came a rise in the number of Afro-Indians, Afro-Europeans, Afro-Euro-Indians. Mixed people soon began to outnumber those of so-called pure blood. By the end of the 1700s, quote-unquote pure Africans were disappearing, disease and intermarriage were also reducing so-called pure Indians, pure Spaniards, and Europeans. It was becoming ever more difficult to classify one type of race from another. It's really interesting to me. I don't think most people give too much thought to the origin of Latin American people today. At best, it might occur to them that they're partially descended from American Indians, perhaps mixed with Europeans. That's true, but the African element of the origin is rarely brought up, and is critical to a full understanding. Before later migrations in the late 1800s brought more Europeans into the majority, Americans became a society made up of a mix of all the world's people. And I do mean all of them, because we're still missing yet one more part of the picture here. Tens of thousands of Asian immigrants who had also come to the Americas from across the Pacific, via the silver trade, as sailors, servants, or slaves. Many worked on European ships, leaving the Philippines when Europeans themselves were reluctant to make the long, dangerous trip. Many of the Asian immigrants who came to the Americas this way never went back. Instead, they jumped ship in any number of places, taking jobs in shipyards and elsewhere. Even though all Asians were referred to as a group collectively as Chinos, they were from all sorts of lands, not only China. In fact, Japanese samurai patrolled highways and guarded silver shipments across Mexico, just for one example. The most concentrated Asian population in the Americas was in Mexico City, which held the first Chinatown of the New World. In the bustling central market, Chinese shopkeepers and craftsmen competed with and, in some cases, drove out of business Europeans, Africans, and Indians in the same fields. Of particular note to those concerned with eating is the field of dental health. In pre-industrial times, most dentistry was performed of all people by barbers, who were considered low-grade medical providers. At the time, Chinese dentistry was the most sophisticated in the world. Chinese barbers knew how to prevent cavities by scraping away plaque, and they used herbs and roots made into paste that had actual antibacterial and anti-inflammatory effects. As such, Chinese barbers took over Mexico City and dominated their competition. The widespread success of Asian businesses was reflective of the broader increase in Asian population. Mexico and other parts of Latin America soon became actual gateways to the East, or in this case, to the West, where valuable knowledge about China and the Indies and the rest of Asia could be gathered firsthand. Now, at last, jumping around plenty, I think we have all the pieces. African, European, Asian, Indian, all together. They made Mexico City the most diverse place in the world. To put it simply, to understate it really, Mexico City was a cosmopolitan place. But it was so much more than that. It was the world's first true global city. All the world's people colliding and becoming ingredients in a great global stew. This was the first original melting pot in the Americas, the before now abstract idea of the Columbian Exchange embodied in human form. I'm quoting Charles Manigan to say that it was a place where East met West under an African and Indian gaze, all these people, all the world's people, jostling, mixing, competing, fighting, menaced by environmental problems, torn by ethnic struggles and corruption, troubled by a past that it barely understood, all of this sounds pretty familiar, doesn't it? Colonial Mexico City was a startlingly contemporary place. Really the first 21st century city in the 17th century. Globalized, troubled, and modern. And as always, when people change, or when people mix, their cuisine follows suit. So let's talk about why Mexican and Latin food overall, and just about every country that serves a version of it, is so interesting and delicious. You can of course see episodes 3 and 10 for a full description of the culinary traditions already in place by Indians in the Americas and their impressive agricultural complex. But when the Spanish arrived, they let loose all the European crops and animals into that tradition. Cattle, horses, and pigs were soon running feral and reproducing across the new wilderness. Chickens, wheat, old world fruits and veggies, which often went rampant and displaced native fauna. Just like the humans themselves, the foods they brought with them made new hybrid cuisines. Ingredients from the old world mixing with the corn, chilies, tomatoes, avocados, chocolate, and local seafood. Latin America is the global birthplace of fusion cuisine. Today we take this sort of thing for granted, because we live in an even more interconnected and globalized world that Columbus had really just gotten going in the 16th century. Chefs today mix cuisines together all the time in an attempt to make something new. But here in the New World, in the old heartlands of the Aztec and the Inca and other empires, was now a brand new, completely different kind of food and society. Let's just scratch the surface of some really prominent examples. Mexican cuisine itself is perhaps the first and best known of these early fusion traditions. Think about the endless array of sweets and confections in a Mexican bakery. Only possible once wheat and sugar made their way to the Americas. We already made mole on the blog, but I need to mention it here. While chili pepper sauces existed in pre-Hispanic Mexico, the complicated moles of today certainly did not. Said to have been invented by mixed-race Mexican nuns, mole was a true fusion of old and new world foods. You've got chili and chocolate as your main flavor bases, mixed with meat stock, bread, Eurasian seeds, nuts, and spices, and often pork or other meat. The Spanish conquest and incursion would ensure that their love of pork and pork products in particular carried over to the New World, ever thereafter being the quintessential meat in Mexican cooking. The Spanish also introduced the technique of frying in pork fat, which of course is a miracle in of itself and makes everything taste delicious. Before their conquest, the Mesoamerican diet contained very little meat besides domestic turkey, and dairy products were basically absent. Love of eating pigs aside, the Spanish also popularized beef, goat, and sheep. A goat from Europe or Asia, cooked in a pit with ancient Mesoamerican techniques, results in barbacoa. Mexican cheesemaking grew out of contact with Spanish and African traditions. Mainly all those goats, sheep, and cattle they brought with them. Over time, the blending of indigenous and Eurasian peoples birthed a whole new cheesemaking tradition, particularly today in the states of Oaxaca and Chihuahua, both regions having their own famous cheeses named after them. But really, there are different cheesemaking traditions across Mexico. Queso fresco, cotija, again, just naming the most famous ones. Cheesemaking is often a home-based activity, with types and varieties varying that much from household to household. Beyond Mexico, though, we find a whole world of unique but similar stories all across the Americas. Think about the famous cheese buns in Brazil, or how their love of steakhouses and buffets of different meats go back to the Europeans and Africans bringing their animals over. In Argentina, the cowboy culture, and therefore love of beef, to even rival modern America, was born and has persisted into its cuisine to this day. Who but the staunchest vegetarians could ever resist a platter of asado, grilled meats piled high? And then there's rice. Next to corn, the most common grain in Latin America. In some cases, rice surpasses corn and does become the staple in people's foods in places like Ecuador. Combined with seafood in the port of Veracruz in the 1520s was where it first arrived via Spanish migrants. Though the Spanish were the first to bring rice to Latin America, it was likely Asian immigrants who showed people what to do with it. Chifa cuisine on the Peruvian coast is a delicious medley between Asian and South American cooking. Fried rice with creamy ají verde, lomo saltado. Beyond Chinese cooking, you also find tons of Japanese influence on dishes on the coasts of Chile and Peru, particularly in the realm of hot cuisine and fine dining, and especially in regards to the treatment of seafood. Or let me veer another way and ask this. Who could imagine Central American or Colombian food without plantains? There's dulce de leche, empanadas, our friends sugar and wheat again, with butter and pork fat thrown into the mix. And how could we talk about Latin food without limón? All citrus, really, but especially lemons and limes. Acidic flavors are the order of the day every day in just about all Latin cuisines. There are other contributors to this sour flavor profile, especially tomatoes and chocolate, but it's citrus that really brings this acid diet home. Ceviche, all down the South American coast, most famously in Peru, is a perfect melding of ingredients from different hemispheres. Local ocean fish and veggies, my favorite combo being the classic corn, onions, and sweet potato, all brought together with a magical, sour fruit born in Southeast Asia. Acid from lime or lemon juice cures the fish, cooking it without heat and taking on its flavor, making a dressing whose deliciousness is hard to describe. Ceviche is a culinary masterpiece, and it's only possible with globalization. You can see that in all the countries of Latin America. They have cuisines born out of fusion between all the major peoples and foods of the world. As always, food reflected exactly what was happening with societies and actual people on the ground. Hybrid societies, hybrid cuisine. The political and culinary landscape after Columbus's voyage didn't just look different. It was born anew, into something that had not been possible until 1492. From that point forward, the world would change faster than people living in it could keep up with. If you think the slippery and ever-shifting history we covered today was disorienting, buckle up, because we're still just in the beginnings. We're on a treadmill now, starting slowish here with the reconnection of the hemispheres, and accelerating faster and faster as the geopolitics and nature of societies continue evolving until eventually we manage to create the modern world. We see, unfortunately, that the stage was set from the very beginning to build this new world with the plantation and thus the slave labor system, as the new economies of the day became hopelessly tied up with it. A whole new system for politicking and waging war went along with it. Corporations and companies who acted as government-sanctioned monopolies and de facto state representatives jostling with each other and raiding each other's colonies all over the world's shipping lanes, muscling in on trade routes and economies as a way of weakening their foes and taking their power. In the end, all this colonizing and greed and profiteering would be dominated by just a few luxury goods in high demand, a few crops which came to control the new global economy. We explored sugar today, mentioned tobacco just a little bit, but the story will continue next episode with the rest of that short list, when we fully explore what comes next for Europe in its new world of capitalism and coffee. Thanks for sticking with me through this troubling time and through such a wide scope for an episode. Thank you especially to all my regular listeners for your ever-increasing patience. Trust me, I'm fully aware I've only gotten slower at putting out these episodes as the podcast has gone on. Both life events like having a child as well as veering out of my historical comfort zone have both contributed. I promise, though, if you stick with me, the episodes will keep coming out. Even if they come out when they come out, if you follow me. However, with my day job at the restaurant officially locked down and myself being quarantined at home for the foreseeable future, I have a feeling you might be hearing from me sooner than we're all used to. Or maybe it'll take twice as long and I'll kick myself for ever promising that, but anyway, I'll see you next time, exactly whenever that happens to be.